Greetings to you all. Good afternoon. First of all, I want to thank the Brethren of Agawam for the effort of putting on a convention. And they've been putting on conventions for a long time. And I missed the first four Agawam conventions, but I was at number five. And as you see on the program, they've had almost 75 of them. So I didn't get to all of them, but I remember as a youngster, the blessings of going there and seeing the Gonzuski family, the Zielinski family, the Kwiatkowski family. They were all part of our lives. So. Secondly, I want to thank the translators and the technical people for their help. And thirdly, I bring you warm Christian love and greetings from the Bible students in Seattle with whom we meet. Who was Luke? Good question. And it has a wonderful answer. Luke was a highly educated, good man. He was highly skilled in the Greek language, and he's the only Gentile that wrote in the New Testament. Now, we know the Bible and the New Testament especially is a product of the Jewish culture. The Jews are a very distinct group. They had to be different to survive as long as they have. And judging by what we see of the Jewish culture, the Jews were unique many ways. They're unique today. They were unique back in the old days. They had a sense of humor that was unmatched. They had outstanding business skills. Many solid family traditions. And all of the New Testament writers came from that Jewish culture except for Luke. Everything we read in the scriptures is from that culture. It's through Jewish eyes. It has a Jewish perspective, except for Luke. Now, none of this makes one view better than the other. But it's just a different perspective. It's different. And maybe that's refreshing. And for most of us, the Gentile perspective is probably a little bit more like we are, because most of us are Gentiles. And Luke wrote a little bit more than 25% of the New Testament. In comparison, the Apostle Paul just wrote a tiny bit more. Technically, it's like 29%. And between the two of them, they wrote over half the New Testament. The Gospel of Luke is the longest book in the New Testament. In my Bible, it's like 38 pages. And the second writing of Luke, the second book that he wrote, is the second longest writing in the New Testament. My Bible, it's 36 pages. So that's this over 25% of the New Testament. The point is that if we want to understand the gospel of Jesus Christ, Luke needs to be at least one of our two favorite authors. Today, we will see what Luke thought about and what he thought was important. Let's start by saying that I'm going to give you a little warning that I'm going to take exception to the title given to Luke's second writing. It's not terribly important. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but there is a point to it that maybe is important. In his second writing, this is after the Gospel of Luke, The usual title is The Acts of the Apostles. And I think that after some discussion, we can come up with a better name. There are 28 chapters in this second writing of Luke. And the 28 chapters could nicely be divided into some smaller sections. And that would probably make it easier to remember and to find if we're looking for a particular incident, if we divide it into sections. Now, the first section would be the first 12 chapters. The first 12 chapters are mostly like the original 12 apostles. See, that makes it a little easier to understand. Now, you and I know that there's really only 11 apostles left at this point in time because the betrayal has taken place and the departure of Judas. So Luke starts with the story of the 11. This is the beginning activities of the followers of Jesus Christ, and he's documenting it. Chapter 1, Jesus says farewell to the 11. Chapter 2, that beautiful story of Pentecost. Chapter 3, story of Peter and John going out and preaching. And they actually go up into the temple and they heal the lame man. Now, the next group of chapters, 4 through 8, documents the growth of this new organization, this new fellowship. And it has its ups and downs. Chapter 4, there's a rather violent response from the traditional Jews, and they attack the new group. Paul and John are put into prison. These are details of the growth of the church. Chapter 5 documents the sad story of some of the church members lying about the contributions that they were making, and they died for that. Chapter 6, we see the organization develop, and they appoint deacons. They need assistance. They need help to deal with all the work that's starting to happen with this new fellowship. Chapter 7 is about one of the deacons, Stephen, and the great persecution he suffered. Chapter 8 is about another deacon, Philip, his work in Samaria, and their enthusiastic conversion. So we see what is happening. The church is growing. And of course, there are growing pains. There's strong resistance from the Jews. And as we saw, some of the followers are put in prison and some are even killed. And as a result of these attacks, there's a scattering of the believers. And the believers take off. They go in all directions. And we know, of course, providentially, they spread out through the Roman world. Now, the last section of 4 chapters left of this original 12 chapters, this foundation, we see introduced for the first time Gentiles. And in chapter 9 is the miracle of Saul's conversion. Saul's on his way to Damascus. You know the story. Saul starts to preach in Damascus. The Jews try to kill him, both in Damascus and in Jerusalem. And then in chapter 10, more about Gentiles. This is about the Roman centurion Cornelius. Here's a Gentile who is converted. And of course, Peter gets called on the carpet by the authorities in Jerusalem, so to speak, the authorities, for his action in even dealing with the Gentiles when he comes back. Rather euphoric about what had happened. In chapter 11, acceptance of the Jewish, the Jews are starting to accept the Gentile idea, and there are conversions taking place outside of Jerusalem, as far away as Antioch. That's way up north. And we're introduced to the brother named Barnabas. In chapter 12, which is now the end of this first section about the apostles and their deacons, we see James, the leader, is killed by Herod, and Peter is in prison. That's the first 12 chapters. That's the foundation of this book that Luke wrote. Now, from this point on, it's all about Saul. That's his Jewish name, or sometimes he goes by Paul, his other name, which would be kind of more user-friendly to the Gentile audiences that he's going in front of. The remaining chapters, 13 all the way through 28, focus on Paul. It's all about Paul. And even that can be divided into separate sections. The first section could be his pilgrim trips. The second section could be his time in Jerusalem, and then finally in Rome. And before we jump into this, the second part of this writing of Luke, I want to recount in more detail how the transition took place, because it didn't just happen. It's a wonderful story, and recounting it makes us feel that these are real people, and they're making decisions from day to day. They have daily lives. They have jobs. And we see in these details how Jehovah intended and overruled the process of growth of this new church. So let's step back a little bit, back into the first 12. And let's look at chapter 9 and see how we got from the original group of actors, the 11 and 12 apostles, and the leaders of that group, and how we transform and transmit up to the new group of actors and the new leaders. And you'll notice the names are going to change. There will be new names. You're not going to hear again about Philip. You're not going to hear anything about Stephen or even Peter or John. New people step up. But keep in mind, there's one thing that doesn't change. And that's what's so important to Luke. I think a map helps here. So I have a map. I hope you can see it. And the action always centered in Jerusalem. And on this map, it's at the bottom of the map. And I've marked Jerusalem with a big yellow arrow at the bottom of the map. Now, Saul's conversion on the road to Damascus, that's the second arrow up, and I put a red circle around it. And Saul was traveling the road to Damascus from Jerusalem up north a little bit to Damascus. And this is one of the great stories of all history. Where this man, Ananias, is chosen to welcome Saul of Tarsus into the new brotherhood of Jesus. This is a big miracle. And when Ananias says to Saul, "Brother Saul," that is one of the most amazing things ever said by anybody in the history of the world. That is such an expression of brotherly love. How could Ananias say that to this troublemaker, this persecutor, this accomplice to murder? Even though he's sitting there now, blind and disabled, boy, I think I would have come in, I would have started reminding Saul of all the bad things he did. Ananias comes in and he says, "Brother Saul." It's just so beautiful. I know you know the story. And Saul is immediately turned around. He immediately starts preaching Jesus Christ. And this is takes place in Damascus, and it's recorded in the 9th chapter and in verse around 23. And of course, immediately the Jews take counsel to kill him. Now, let's see here. Saul, therefore, he was in Damascus. He returned to Jerusalem. And you know, the same thing happens there. He's too well known. He's got a reputation. He's got like a rap sheet. And he kind of creates a firestorm in Jerusalem. And you know what? The apostles decide in chapter 9 that he is not worth the trouble. They don't need him there, infuriating the Jews, the traditional Jews. And so they tell him to go home. This is in chapter 9, verse 29 and 30. To say it briefly, they took him to Caesarea. They put him on a boat and they sent him home to Tarsus. Now, on our map, Tarsus is way at the top with the blue arrow. Okay, so they got rid of him and things did calm down in Jerusalem. Now, going to Tarsus was not exactly punishment. Tarsus was a famous city. It was a regional capital of the Roman Empire. You may remember the history. Antony and Cleopatra made this city famous because this was the location of their first romantic encounter. Cleopatra took a cruise to Rome. That's how I like to think of it. She was living in Egypt. She took a cruise to Rome. She met Antony there, and they decided to have a second date. And then guess where it was? It was in Tarsus. It kind of made the city famous. And that's what gave that city the Roman status. And that's why Paul has citizenship as a Roman born in Tarsus, because otherwise it's just a city in Turkey. Now, the next interesting step jumps to chapter 11. From 9, we jump to 11. 10, remember, in between was the conversion of Cornelius. So you see what's happening here is that there's more and more talk about the Gentiles. And the talk here now goes to the city of Antioch. Now, I've added another arrow to the map, and Antioch is up north. And in chapter 11, Antioch's a big city. It's very important. It's a large center of trade. It's one of the entry routes to the famed Silk Road that led to the Orient. And the believers started to grow in number. And the Jerusalem headquarters, the authorities there, the brethren, and forgive me for calling them this, but they're kind of control freaks. And they became worried that these new converts, especially up in Antioch, were not going to know what they were doing. So they said, somebody's got to go there. And who do they pick? Their number one ambassador. This is the fellow, the brother who could get along with everyone. And that's Barnabas. So in chapter 11, they send Barnabas up north from Jerusalem up to the second yellow arrow now. And that's Antioch, and he's supposed to make sure everything is going well. And verse 22 says, when the church in Jerusalem got wind of this, they sent Barnabas to Antioch to check on things. 23, as soon as he arrived, he saw that God was behind and in it all. He threw himself in with them. He got behind them, urging them to stay with it the rest of their lives. Verse 24, he was a good man that way, enthusiastic and confident in the Holy Spirit's ways. The community grew large and strong in the Master. Now, here comes the fun part. I think, this is a tiny bit of my own personal speculation, Barnabas gets overwhelmed. He's a great ambassador and a people person, but maybe he's not the best teacher in the world. They're asking him questions he can't handle. So he says, my interpretation, I need some help. Now look at the map. Do you see what has happened here? Paul was sent up to Antioch. That's the blue arrow. Barnabas is sent up to Antioch. Did I say Tarsus? Paul was sent to Tarsus, and Barnabas is sent to Antioch. Do you see how close they are now? But they were going on separate missions. That wasn't planned. It wasn't planned by them. It's planned by Jehovah. So, make the long story a little bit shorter. Barnabas decides he goes over to Tarsus, and in that whole city, he says, I'm going to find Saul. I need help. He finds Saul. No surprise, right? They go back to Tarsus, and they work with these brethren there for over a year. Now, what's at work here? Why is Luke telling this story? He's talking about the Holy Spirit and how it is building the new church of Jesus Christ. Verse 26, we're still in chapter 11, is one of the most beautiful scriptures ever written. It goes like this. It was in Antioch that the disciples were for the first time called Christians. How thrilling is that? So we see that the rest of the writing is all about Paul from this point on, from his introduction back into Antioch. From this point on, it's about Paul's pilgrim trips, Paul's time in Jerusalem, and Paul's final trip to Rome. So this is where we go back and we ask, why did Luke write this? It's not church history. Yes, it is in a sense. It's not a travelogue of Paul's pilgrim trips. This is about the work of the Holy Spirit. And we get the key in the first chapter because Luke starts off with what's this important point. In those first few verses, verse 4 is, wait for what my Father has promised. And verse 5, you will be baptized. Jesus is speaking. You will be baptized with the Holy Spirit. That's the key to this entire writing. You will be baptized. It's not important what cities Paul visited or how long he stayed there. Yes, we learned something from everything we read. But there's a more important lesson that covers the entire book. It's how the Holy Spirit of the Father works with his people. The promise that we would get his Spirit. It's like, I would like to just shout that out. We would get the Father's Spirit. What does it mean to get Jehovah's Spirit? Let's try to answer first, just generally, what's a spirit? The most simple way that I can imagine to really simplify it is the spirit is who you are. Who you are. You cannot be one thing and at the same time the opposite. You're only one thing. What you think, your emotions, your values, your decisions, your desires, your intentions, that's your spirit. If you think bad thoughts, you cannot be a good spirit. If you think good thoughts, you can't be a bad spirit. Your spirit is who you, what you are. Now imagine what Jehovah's Spirit is, his values, his intentions. His emotions, his decisions. You have been promised a share of that spirit. that spirit will manifest who you are, who you need to be, or who you are becoming. So I'm suggesting that this book, this second writing of Luke, is not a history story. I'm suggesting a new title. It should be The Acts of the Holy Spirit, The Acts of the Father's Spirit. Pencil it in. You can erase it later if you change your mind. Acts of the Apostles. No, that doesn't mean that much to us personally. But the Acts of the Holy Spirit, the Acts of the Father's Spirit, that means a lot to us. Now let's look at the diversity of the Spirit. We see what Jesus' instructions were in that first chapter. He talks about us being baptized. He says it gives us power. And they say hey, the Holy Spirit, he says, was spoken of in the Old Testament. Go to the second chapter. There's the begettal of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit again referenced that this was predicted in chapter 2, verse 33 and 34. Holy Spirit is manifest. And in 38, 39, it's a gift. That's where that marvelous concept of grace and mercy comes in. It just goes on almost every chapter. Chapter 4, the Holy Spirit is in action with Peter. The Holy Spirit, again, referenced in the Old Testament. Peter says, this is what was predicted. The begettal of the Holy Spirit is mentioned in chapter 4. Chapter 5, again, Holy Spirit, but the sad part is where Ananias and Sapphira are found out that they lied to the Holy Spirit. Chapter 5 also calls the Holy Spirit the gift of the Holy Spirit. Chapter 6, Holy Spirit in action. Chapter 7, Holy Spirit in action. You see the point? It goes on and on almost every single chapter. And what is it that this Holy Spirit is doing to us? These are the things it can do. And we're going to borrow from some of the things that Paul wrote later in some of his books. It tells us to do things. It teaches us. We're kept, we're protected by the Holy Spirit. It searches all things. It expresses things without emotion, without words. It can mean emotion. It can mean spirit. It can mean intentions. It can mean perceptions. Paul calls it a gift again in 1 Corinthians. He says there are different gifts. And the Holy Spirit apparently has feelings too, because it says in Acts 15, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit. At the same time, the Holy Spirit can also be damaged. It can be lied to. It can be resisted. People can speak against it. It can be tested. Ephesians 4:30, the Holy Spirit can feel bad. We can make the Holy Spirit feel bad. Paul says that the letter of the law kills the spirit. Spirit can be contaminated. Galatians 5:16, the desires of the sinful nature destroy the spirit. Now, this next slide is the worst slide in PowerPoint I ever made in my life. But I had to put down all the things that I could pull out of this second writing of Luke. And I encourage you to do the same thing. Read through this writing of Luke and make a list of all the things that the Holy Spirit does. It caused riots, exposed liars. It just goes on and on. It transformed a terrorist we're talking about Paul, into messengers of peace. It guides movements to be more inclusive. It let some of its directees be stoned, shipwrecked, confronted, argued with, jailed. It filled and directed the lives of thousands of people. The Holy Spirit is who you are. Okay, except for your bones and muscles and a few other material pieces, who you are is your spirit. Is your spirit loving? Is it kind? Does your spirit make good decisions? There's also a spirit of jealousy. There's a spirit of competitiveness. I think it's your choice. Ephesians 5:18. Paul says, be filled with the Spirit. And in Luke 11, this is in Luke's first gospel, right? 11:13, he quotes Jesus and saying, if you know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give his Spirit to those who ask him? That's probably the number one requirement then. Ask for more of God's Spirit. Ask that God's Spirit would permeate every thought, every intention, every decision, every behavior, every emotion. Your responsibility is to let the Father's Spirit be your guiding force. Let it be your operating power, your decision maker. Look for the Spirit in places you don't even imagine it would be. Acknowledge everything the Spirit does. It's there. We have to recognize it. And certainly, we have to pray for it. Be the Spirit Jehovah invites you to be. Be the Spirit that Jehovah intends you to be. So I hope you will enjoy reading through the Acts of the Father's Spirit. Thank you. And may the Lord add his blessing.